Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. You can also send me an email. I would love to hear from you. Any comments, suggestions, anything, just send me an email, SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I really want to appreciate you guys. We're headed towards 75,000 downloads of the podcast. Could not have done that without your support. So I really want to say thank you, thank you, and thank you. Also, I want to say happy holidays. I know it's a little early, but in case you're, you know, somewhere where you're not near a phone or the internet and you're not around next week, I just want to say happy Thanksgiving to everybody, and please be safe during the holiday times. This morning, wow, you guys know I do a lot of shows about a lot of different issues, but these types of shows really touch me. I'm a mother. Many of you know that I have a daughter, and I really advocate for the safety of young people, whether they're girls or boys. So these types of shows are very important to me. Rachel Lloyd is the executive director and founder of GEMS and the author of the book Girls Like Us. She herself was in the life, so to speak, as they call it, but she got out. And she has the prestigious Reebok Human Rights Award. She is a Shoka Fellow, and she's a Prime Mover Fellow. She was a leading advocate for the Safe Harbor and Exploited Youth Act, and now she continues helping children through her GEMS organization. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for calling in. Again, I want to mention to the callers, I'm speaking with Rachel Lloyd. She's the author of Girls Like Us. And she talks about her story in the life in human trafficking and how she got out and what she's doing now to help other girls who are in the life domestically here in the United States. I want to read a little bit from your book, Rachel, just in the beginning about the young lady, Danielle.
Okay.
So, you know, the reason I started GEMS is because I used to be in the life, too. So I wanted to have a place for girls who've been through the same thing. Silence. That admission normally at least provoked a question. Really, miss? How old was you? What track you work? You had a daddy? But nothing. Not even a raised eyebrow or a show of interest. Can you tell me what brought you here today? Silence. This is a little tougher than I expected, or to be honest, wanted, particularly at the end of a long week. A lot of girls I encountered in this situation started chatting right away, and it was harder to getting them to be quiet. So I know that your name's Danielle. Can I ask how old you are? I'd already been told over the phone by the intake worker that she's 14, and it is a closed-ended question, bad move in counseling process. But I'm not really getting anywhere, so I figured that this will at least get her to respond. She breaks her silence. 11. I'm so mentally prepared for a different answer that it takes a moment to register. Double take. I'm sorry. How old? 11. Really? So that's the opening part of Rachel's book, Girls Like Us. Just tell me a little bit, a little more about Danielle. I just want to share a little bit with the audience what you learned after learning how old she was.
Well, Danielle had been brought in. She'd been found at Port Authority bus station and had been brought in by child welfare and fortunately had not been arrested, which at that time was reasonably common for girls. I mean, this is going back 4 years, maybe it's not even that long ago, but it was like kind of pre the Safe Harbor Act that you just talked about, that we passed the legislation that we passed that protected girls. And they had called, the child welfare agency had called and said, you know, we've got a 14-year-old, you know, she's not talking to anyone, can you come down? And I had, it was late on, very late on a Friday night, and I had gone down there, and I can remember thinking, oh my God, 11 years old. And as we began to talk, she'd been in the life, she'd been domestically trafficked up and down the East Coast, like Virginia, Maryland, D.C., she'd been sold on Craigslist, and both of her sisters, who were 14 and 16 were both being trafficked as well, and that's how she'd gotten into the life. And she was a kid who'd been in foster care since she was about 3 years old. And then her whole history of kind of trauma and abuse and neglect and abandonment was heartbreaking. And, you know, I mean, she felt that the guy who was selling her, this adult man who was in his late 20s who was selling her, was the most kind of connected she'd ever been to an adult. He was the most, you know, kind of interested in her life. So the fact that he was selling her on the internet didn't matter as much to her as it did the fact that somebody actually paid attention to her.
Well, that's one of the issues that you do talk about in the book, is these are these acts of kindness that the girls just really hold on to while they're in the life. I want to talk a little bit about your experience. You were over in the UK and then you came to US. But can you share with the audience a little bit about your background and how you got into the life and that just path, that kind of tumbling path that led you into the life a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Portsmouth, England, and grew up. I mean, I think when you say you grew up in England to Americans, people often think that you sit around kind of drinking tea and talking about the Queen, right? And right, like we have kind of poverty in England, and we've got projects and right violence, and so I think people. It just gives people I don't know, that we all sit around and have butlers or something. But, you know,
I know that's not true. I've been overseas and I've seen ghettos, and a ghetto is a ghetto is a ghetto, and oppression is oppression is oppression.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
You know, how people deal with it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and so where I grew up in England, I mean, it was reasonably rough, and my mother, when I was very small, was, I mean, honestly, a great mother, and I think that saved my life in many ways. But, you know, as I got a little bit older, she began to drink, and, you know, there was a series of stepfathers and uncles and not so great men in her life, right? And I mean, understanding, right, the disease of alcoholism, which I didn't understand as a kid, but as an adult have a lot more understanding and compassion for, right? I mean, she just really struggled very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time I was about 13, I was kind of just on my own. And when you're a 13-year-old girl without any adults around, you know, there are other adult men who are interested in you and pay attention to you, and, you know, and so I got involved in all kinds of stuff and ended up, by the time I was like, I actually left England because I was involved in all kinds of domestic violence, and I had a criminal record by that point, and I'd been an alcoholic by that time since I was about 13, and I left England when I was 17 to get away and to start a new life, and had been told that they had jobs in Germany, and got to Germany and realized I didn't speak German, and had bought a one-way ticket because I was 17, and that's how your brain works at that age. And got stuck in a foreign country with no money, and ended up going to work in a strip club. And I mean, that's how kind of things started. I mean, and then ended up meeting a guy who, you know, presented as my boyfriend, but would very quickly become my pimp. And so, yeah, I mean, I think my story is not that dissimilar to many of the young women that we serve, in that, you know, there's that point where you kind of enter, right, the life, but I mean, there's all these other points that have kind of prepared you on various levels, through sexual abuse, through trauma, through watching your mom get beaten up, through, do you know what I mean, all these experiences, and the media. I mean, I think I can remember when I entered, I mean, this is going back some years now, right, but Pretty Woman had been out for a few years, and I thought, well, somebody's going to come and rescue me, right? I mean, I'm going to meet Richard Gere. And, you know, so I'm in a, and I'm in for girls who are entering now. I'm in, you know, the kind of glorification of pimp culture and the sex industry and stripping. I mean, right, girls are coming in with these ideas about, you know, what has been sold to them by the
media. What's
going to
happen?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you talk about is that, you know, choices. And there was a very powerful section because people always wonder, like, you know, well, you know, well, why would they? Don't they know any better? Here in the U.S., we don't have the problems that people in other, you know, countries have, which we still do. We're in denial, but you know, so they're like, well, why would they do that? Don't they know any better? We have lots of resources here. But one of the things you do talk about is the choices, and that the young ladies, and including yourself, you made a choice that you thought was appropriate at the time, and at the time you were still a child. You were still developing, and they, too, are still developing. Girls like Danielle, she's 11, 12, 13, 14. I mean, yes, you can make choices at 16 that might be amazing to an adult, and people say, oh, she's so mature. But actually, physically, in terms of development, you're not mature. So you make these immature decisions, rash decisions. But also, some of the choices, there were no other choices. The girls didn't have resources. They didn't have family support. As a matter of fact, they were running away from their families. You know, I had a guest on, a filmmaker, he wrote a book called Boulevard, and talking about homeless teens in California, you know, and how a lot of them get into the life because they don't have any place to go back to. Going back to where they were is worse, you know. But I just wanted to mention about choices. And in your book you talk about, it says the American Heritage Dictionary says the act of choosing as to select from a number of possible alternatives, decide on and pick out. And a lot of these young ladies don't have a lot of choices. This is their only choice, or what they think is their only choice at the time. I want to just go ahead. You had a comment.
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate you bringing that piece up because I think the choice question is such a critical part of this, and I think this is where people get stuck around often. And so this idea, well, you weren't chained to a wall, right? You didn't have a gun to your head the entire time. You could have chosen to leave. You chose to meet this guy, get in this car. And, I mean, so, you know, when we're talking, you brought up those kind of two critical points. A, it has to be, like, the context of the choice. You made a choice, but you made a choice to not get sexually abused at home anymore. Or you made a choice to run away from the foster care agency that you felt was treating you terribly. Or, right, I mean, and the just developmental level of young people making choices. And it's not to say that children can't make any choices, but I mean, right, when we do trainings and we ask adults in the room, okay, describe yourself at 14, 15, 16, what kind of choices were you making, right? People are mortified, and yet those are the same. And when we ask people, would you let your 16-year-old kid, you know, run your house for a week without you there, or drive your car for a week without you knowing about it, right? No, because we recognize that young people need structure and safety and boundaries, and we recognize when we were 15, 16, we were making all kinds of choices that, you know, for many people, right, they did have some structure and safety, and so they made choices, but the consequences weren't kind of awful because they had parents and a family structure and a community structure around them. And so for the young people that we serve, they're making normal adolescent choices, right? To meet a guy, to smoke some weed, those are normal adolescent choices. And yet there's not that safety and structure around them. And they're coming into contact with an adult man whose sole focus in life is to make them compliant, loyal, and sell them. Right. And then when we talk to people about, you know, kind of your first love at 14, 15, 16 or whatever, right? Again, people, you know, kind of get mortified thinking about kind of, oh my goodness, I was so in love with that person.
So naive.
And then right? Yeah. I mean, oh, we're gonna get married and we're gonna be together forever. And if that person had been a pimp, right, how well would you have walked away from that situation?
Well
would you have been able to manage?
That's one of the keys. Let's talk about that, recruitment of the young girls. And who is at risk for being recruitment? I think this is an important topic we have to bring up. Again, we're talking, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Rachel Lloyd, the founder of GEMS Organization and also the author of the book Girls Like Us. The call-in number is 646-929-0368. We're talking about her experience in the sex trafficking industry and her subsequent escape and now her activism on behalf of young ladies in the United States and globally, but particularly in the United States. This issue of recruitment and the issue of predominantly more young girls of color, more young girls from poverty. Poverty is something you really emphasized a lot in the book. Just talk a little bit more about how that makes recruitment so easy.
Yeah, I mean, look, any young person can be at risk for being recruited into the commercial sex industry, right? But
right.
We know that there are young people who are much higher risk. And so I think one of the challenges over the last few years is, as folks have, you know, look, we've all been fighting to get more attention for this issue, is people want to portray the Midwest, middle-class white girl being kidnapped and chained to a wall, right? Because they feel like, okay, that's what, you know, middle America will kind of relate to, right? That's what the general public will relate to. That's not really what this issue generally looks like, right? It looks like low-income young people, and in this country, right, it's very hard to separate out race and class, right? I mean, those two things are kind of inextricably linked. And so
they're married.
They are married for a very long time. And so when we're talking about low-income young people, right, we're predominantly talking about low-income young people of color, girls of color, who are already not high on anybody's priority list, period, who are already, right? I mean, we could talk about all the stereotypes and ideas about girls of color and their sexuality and what they deserve and all that kind of stuff, right? And so, I mean, if you're a young person growing up in poverty in this country, which is, right, you said we're in denial about the realities of poverty and kind of social challenges in this country. But, I mean, we've got young people growing up in this country whose lives, frankly, without some level of intervention, whose lives are often determined by the zip code that they're born in, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who don't have access to good quality education, who don't have access to support services that young people need, who don't have access to green spaces and parks and, right, all the things that young people kind of need growing up, who are living in substandard housing, who are experiencing and witnessing violence in their communities. And then, right, young people who are experiencing not just within their community, because, right, there are young people who are growing up in poverty who are very strongly connected to,
right,
to their place of worship, to their school, to their family, right? I mean, that's not, I think, right, we've got families who are growing up, who are raising children in poverty, who are incredibly strong units, but it's very hard to do that. And so,
well, Rachel, I want to interrupt you.
Go ahead.
I want to interrupt you a little bit because I want to move on to this issue of the supports and, you know, the issue of the community being there for the child. And now let's move into, I guess, a little more macro with, like, the police. One of the issues you bring up is the cops and how the cops interact with these young women when they're picked up. And the issue of, for example, in one chapter you talked about a young lady who the pimp was let out on bail, and she was held in jail for 6 months. But the cops know full well that he's a pimp, that he has multiple young women working for him. But he's let out on bail, and the young lady who was prostituted is kept in jail. What's wrong with this picture? Talk to the audience about what's wrong with that picture.
Yeah, I mean, right, there's a trillion things wrong with that picture. I mean, we're beginning to see a shift slowly, but, I mean, it's definitely not kind of happening at the level we need it to. I mean, I think, right, with law enforcement, they've been told that the issue of kind of prostitution is a victimless crime. And if they are arresting anyone, they're arresting the women and the girls. That's just traditionally how it's looked. They have not arrested the pimp, the trafficker. They've definitely not arrested the men who are doing the buying. So it kind of, and that goes for both cops. Right, I mean, in fairness, the cops that night did arrest him, but the system did not keep him in jail. I think this idea that, you know, girls and young women are there as willing participants, you have to see a victim in order to be able to recognize a perpetrator, right? And so
Let's mention about when people think about prostitution, and one of you mentioned this earlier about, we talked about the choices. And one of the things that you emphasize in the book, that the girls are being brought into the life when they're not adults. They're under 18. They're 12, they're 13, they're 14. So, like you said earlier, would you allow the 14-year-old to run your house for a week? Would you allow the 15-year-old to drive your car, you know, around the state? Would you allow, you know, the 16-year-old to run your business? But these are the bulk of the women. They're girls. They're not women. They're in prostitution. So I think it's unfair in my mind to be like they're making a choice, because, again, that goes back to the choice. What's their alternative than being in the life, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about this issue of the pimps, because you're very brave in the book, and you bring up briefly, and I know people might start yelling, but I think it's important to bring up that the pimp is sometimes a victim, too, of their circumstances. I know this is hard maybe for people here, but it's similar with domestic violence situations. The perpetrator may have been abused, may have witnessed abuse, may have never been touched, but witnessed abuse, so then they perpetrate abuse. This is all they know. Again, their choices are limited to their experiences. But you had a specific incident with a young man in the book, and he started arguing and trying to justify, you know, his life in being a pimp. Talk to the audience a little bit about that incident.
Yeah, I had turned up to an emergency room in ICU. I won't share the exact details of the story, but right, she had a family member who was in ICU that night. One of my young women, and so she's in ICU taking care of that. I'm sitting in the waiting room, and so. But I don't know why initially I didn't realize who he was, but like I kind of saw him and I knew that I kind of knew him. And so we like hugged and right. I mean, it was a crisis, right? Folks were close to death and all this kind of stuff, right? So you're like just connecting and talking. And about 20 minutes into the conversation, I realized that he's her former pimp. He's my young woman's former pimp. Right. That I have been on the phone with her, with him in the background screaming that he's going to kill her, right? I mean, this has been somebody who I have dealt with kind of on some level for many years and have, like, hated with a passion. And I'm like, we're, like, chatting, and then I'm like, I had this moment of, like, oh, my God. And so, you know, by that point, we're kind of talking, and he brings up the fact that he's just seen our movie, Very Young Girls, and had watched it on Showtime, which is kind of bizarre. And so we begin to talk, and I was very frank about, right, what you do and the harm that you have caused this young woman who I love like a daughter and would protect, right, beyond anything. Right, and he has a child with her, and so I mean they've had a pretty complex relationship over the years, and I'll say, you know, I mean he was trying to defend it, and I was listening to him, and I mean very like he had a lot of game, right, and I was like, no wonder when she was 15, he was able to kind of talk her ear off and right recruit her
and
that kind of
stuff.
I mean, very very smart, articulate young man. But right as we began to talk, he started talking about kind of his mom being alive and his father being a pimp. And I mean, right, he's the young man who had a real history of trauma and abuse. And yet, right, I mean. You know, I think the only point I can remember him really, it really seemed to kind of sink in for a second, was when I began to talk about slavery, and how was he different than like a slave owner who was put in, right? You're putting the mother of your child up on the auction block every single night, right? And at that point, he kind of like, it was like, there was that moment, and right, and he said, okay, I need help, and I need counseling, and then, you know, like I said, I mean, a couple of weeks later, I found out he was like back in, you know, back in the game again. Yeah, and selling girls. I mean, I mean, I actually know kind of since that he is having those moments of kind of trying to get out for a while and then going back in and abusing women again. I mean,
I want to, Rachel, I want to bring up this interesting, do you mind going a little over, because it's just, I think, such an important issue and such an important activism that you're doing and really trying to make people aware domestically in the United States what's going on, that sex trafficking is this exotic thing, but we have, I know in Philadelphia, I had Hugh Organ, he was head of Philadelphia anti-trafficking, and I had a couple guests on a year back about human trafficking here in the United States, and in Chinatown here in Philadelphia, a Comcast cable guy had was able to help some young women who were behind a wall. They were behind a wall in beds. And, you know, so this is right here in Philadelphia and Chinatown, people, if you're local. But this happens all over the country, you know, New York, California, Michigan, you know, Arizona, wherever you are,
everywhere.
The business is there, you know. But I want to read this thing about Stockholm Syndrome. Many people might be aware of that, but let me just read this. A perceived threat to survival and the belief that one's captor is willing to act on that threat, the captor's perception of small kindness from the captor within a context of terror, isolation from perspectives other than those of the captor, and a perceived inability to escape. Stockholm Syndrome, talk to the audience a little bit, Rachel, about this and why this is so connected to girls in the life.
Well, when we read that for folks, we read that out in a training, and we put that on like the PowerPoint and stuff, and we say, what's the key word in that definition? It's perceived, right? It doesn't actually have to be real. So the gun doesn't have to be to your head, right? The door doesn't have to be steel, reinforced steel that you can't. You just have to believe that this person will harm you. You have to believe that there's an imminent or possible threat to your life. You have to believe that you don't really have the ability to escape. And so that's the thing, right? The physical door, and we know this about domestic violence, the physical door can be open, but if psychologically you feel like you can't leave, that door will sit open all day, and you'll never walk out of it. And so, I mean, I think people are often looking in these situations for, right, an example that you just, right, girls held behind a wall, chained to wall, do you know what I mean? Like that, they kind of get as trafficking. But when a girl looks like she can kind of come and go, and right, and she's American.
She's buying her groceries,
right,
why wouldn't
she be able to, like, run away and escape? And so, I mean, in the book, the two examples I really used were Elizabeth Smart and Sean Hornbeck, and I mean, right, the J.C. Duggar case is also a good example. I mean, there's a few now of, and Patty Hearst, of course, right, but especially with these kids, right, we do not blame Elizabeth Smart for not trying harder to run away, right? I mean, that would be ludicrous. We totally get that she did everything that she needed to do to stay alive and to survive. And, I mean, she's talked, quite frankly, about there being moments, right, where they were out in public. And, yeah, she could have started screaming and
running.
But he had done so much psychological damage by that point. Go ahead.
Rachel, real quick, I want to talk about Biderman's chart of coercion, and that's one of the things you bring up also in the book, monopolization of perception or enforcing, you know, trivial demands. And how it's the step-by-step of breaking down of the person, and that the more traumatic the young woman's background is, the easier it is for them to get drawn into the life. So if this is their norm is being abused, their norm is physical, sexual, emotionally being abused, their norm is being neglected, their norm is barely getting anything, whether it's food, clothing, shelter, love, you know. So then some guy comes in, like you said, that the pimp, he was so smooth and, you know, just articulate, then you're like, wow, I can see why. But there's steps to coercion, and then there's ultimately there's violence. There's always this violence in the life.
It started off as nice, but then that's shattered. One of the really horrific times I do want to bring up in the book, and this is in relation to how cops, we're going to go over a little bit. I appreciate your patience, but one of the issues is when you were driven for 2 miles by the guy, basically you were kidnapped and arrested, and the guy was given your money, and they wanted him to drive you back to Germany. Talk about that just real briefly. We can still keep going a little bit.
Yeah, it was a guy who I was dating who had been quite violent to me, and he kidnapped me one morning when I was leaving my house, beat me unconscious, threw me in his car and told me he was going to take me to Amsterdam and sell me, and then at one point was going to just throw me into a river. And I managed to escape, right? I did what I had to do in the situation, told him I loved him, all this good stuff. In order for us to get back to safety, I escaped. I went to the cops. I did everything kind of I was supposed to do. And because he told them that I worked in a strip club and therefore was a quote-unquote whore, the way that I was treated was as like I'd done something wrong. And so, you know, we were 200 miles away from where I lived. I mean, he'd taken my shoes, right? He'd beaten me. I mean, he had all my money. And when I asked how I was going to get home, because they were releasing him, they told me that he would drive me back home. And look, God bless, there was a female detective cop there. This is in Germany. There was a female cop there who didn't speak a lot of English, who was absolutely horrified by what was going on and took me aside and was crying and slipped like 20 bucks in my pocket, which was enough to get me on the train, and told me that the male cop treated all women who weren't, like, seen as kind of good victims, so women who worked in strip clubs and brothels, et cetera, like this. So, right, God bless her for her kind of moment of kindness. But, I mean, that idea that somebody has just kidnapped you, beaten you, you know, I mean, done all this heinous stuff to you, but, yeah, get back in the car with him, right? Like, he'll drive you home. I mean,
right.
Yeah,
that that's what you talk about.
And then
it
you don't go back
too.
To the cops again after an experience like that, right? When I was
that's
with
what I wanted
him,
to bring up, yeah.
You are not reaching out for help because you do not believe that anyone will help you at that point because it's already been proven that they won't.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to get to is that, yes, you may go to help. You may try to get out. But then when you try to get out, you're constantly, you know, hitting a wall. But I do want to mention in the book, you talk about several cops, and there are cops all over the country who are doing positive things and are helping young women and do try to realize the situation that they're in. But unfortunately, there's a lot of cops and institutions, we'll just say institutions, because the cops are being controlled by these institutions that don't understand that these are children, don't view them as children, view them as adult, as women making a choice to be there, and don't you know any better. But again, like you said in your workshops, when you talk to adults, talk to them about, well, what were you doing at 14, at 15, at 16, at 7, at 18? What were you doing? What choices were you making? What risk were you taking? And then consider that you come from a supportive family, parents who fed you and clothed you and disciplined you properly and all these things, and you still made stupid choices. Now imagine you're coming from no food, no clothes, or very low, or addiction, or, you know, crack, or AIDS, or illness, even a chronic illness. A parent having a chronic illness can and not having resources can affect the child and the child's opportunities in life. So then you have all these marks against you. So then what kind of choices is that young child going to make? You know, I want to move to the end. I know you got to go. But let's talk about the Safe Harbor Act. Tell the audience what exactly the Safe Harbor for Exploited Youth Act is and how it has improved at least some choices for the young ladies.
Safe Harbor for Exploited Youth, I mean, was legislation that we worked on with particularly Kate Mullen, actually, from the Legal Aid Society and some folks from the Juvenile Justice Coalition, because we felt like, why are 12-year-olds being charged with an act of prostitution when in New York State they cannot even legally consent to sex until they're 17? That doesn't make sense. And under federal legislation, right, you don't have to, under the age of 18, you don't have to prove fraud, force, or coercion, right, if a young person is a victim of trafficking. So, I mean, we were seeing girls incarcerated over and over again. And so in 2008, it took 4.5 years to pass this legislation. In 2008, we became the first state to pass safe harbor legislation. Since then, 8 states have followed. In fact, Massachusetts just passed its safe harbor 2 days ago. And it will get signed into law, I think, on Monday. And other states have kind of pending legislation. So, I mean, this is a huge kind of social change in terms of seeing girls as victims as opposed to criminals. I mean, I believe in 5 years we'll get to the point where we'll look back and say, we used to send 13-year-olds to jail for an act of prostitution that they couldn't even legally consent to, let alone kind of morally, developmentally, all that kind of stuff, right? I mean, we need to treat this issue as a child welfare, child protection issue, not as a criminalization issue.
Definitely. I want to talk a little bit about your organization. I want to let the people know they can check out your organization at gems-girls.org. Again, that's gems-girls.org. Also, follow them on Twitter, at gemsgirls. So talk a little bit about your organization. I know you have a lot of different programs and workshops for young women once they come in. One of the things I really liked was getting them politically involved. You use a lot of the girls' stories to help with the Safe Harbor Act. Just talk about how that really changes their life, I guess empowers them by being politically active.
Yeah, I mean, our youth leadership program is kind of one of my favorite pieces of all of our program. And then, look, obviously people need housing and counseling and clothing and food and healthcare and all of that stuff, right, before you don't have folks walk in the door day one and kind of stick them up on a pan, right?
Yeah.
You start to meet people's kind of basic needs and support people and get into a place where, right, this feels empowering. But, I mean, the youth leadership program, we do a lot of education for young people around what trafficking and sexual exploitation looks like globally. We talk to them about issues of race and class and gender and, right, help them kind of have that lens. I mean, and so for girls who have believed for a very long time, this was my fault, this was just me, it's because I'm a bad girl, this is why these things happen to me. For them to be kind of in this group experience and begin to learn, wow, this is happening in Thailand and it's happening in the Ukraine and it's happened to lots and lots of young people around the world and it happens because of these factors and there's something I can kind of do about it. I can use my voice to fight this. That's incredibly empowering. I mean, GEMS, as a survivor-led organization, right, what I realized was how much being able to speak out, right, and stand up against this and not feel ashamed and make the perpetrators feel ashamed, right, was life-changing and healing for me. And so, I mean, Safe Harbor, I mean, would not have passed without the voices and courage and resilience of the young people who trekked up to Albany year after year, who spoke out at press conferences and, I mean, just organized petitions, I mean, all kinds of stuff that young people were involved in. And it's their voices and stories that got upstate legislators, quite frankly, to change their minds about this issue.
I'm sorry, I just want to get a couple more things.
Go ahead.
Council of Daughters, I want to talk to the audience about what that is and how they can get involved with the Council of Daughters.
The Council of Daughters is kind of our national network for women and young women who want to get involved in this issue, right? We've got a lot of folks who've seen the movie, who've read the book, who kind of want to get involved. I mean, part of that is connecting people to what's happening in their own community. I think, you know, we don't necessarily, I mean, look, we accept checks from everywhere, right? And we are always in need of funding. But we also want to be respectful of, right, people are in communities where there might be a really great local community-based organization or there's a need for that. And so how do you, right, GEMS is not the only place in New York where this is, in the country where this is happening. And so connecting folks with what's happening in their own communities, I think, is critical around the country.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story. Thank you for staying on a little longer. Again, I just think it's such an important issue, really, to
understand that it is not this exotic thing, it is not the other, that it's right here, it's in your neighborhoods, it's happening to young people. And I always emphasize to people, you complain about the youth and what's going on with the youth, and they're going down the tubes. I mean, this happens in every generation. Well, I ask you, in the next week, at least in the next, you know, month, make a call. Who are you mentoring? What young person are you mentoring in your life today? If you are out there complaining about the youth, what young person are you mentoring? What time are you giving? What energy are you giving toward changing and advocating for the youth in your environment? The youth are the future. So if you are feeling like they're misguided, don't know where they're going, why are they making their choices, you know, snubbing your nose at them, one, remember, you used to be a youth, and two, what time and energy are you giving to make the change? You know, really look at yourself, you know, if it's not money, if it's a phone call, if it's writing a letter to your council person, to your state legislator, if it's actual physical time, if you're not doing anything, then I really don't have any respect for your complaint, you know. But
amen,
I want to thank Rachel.
Joy. Amen.
Rachel, thank you so much for being on the show. Check out our organization, gems-girls.org. Also, check them out on Twitter at gemsgirls. Also, you're on Facebook. Is it Gems Girls on Facebook also?
Girls Not For Sale on Facebook.
Girls Not For Sale. Okay. Thank you so much. I hope you have a wonderful Saturday, and I wish you continued success with the organization.
Thanks so much, Joy. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Sorry the show went over, but, again, I just thought it was such an important issue. You can follow me on Twitter.com/JoyKeith. You can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keith. And you can send me an email, SaturdaysWithJoyKeith@Hotmail.com. Thank you so much for your support. Headed towards 75,000 downloads of the show. Could not have done that without your support. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful Saturday.